Latin, Reel 3, followed after a short pause by Reel 4. Left channel is informant's mic only, right channel is informant and interviewer.
Well, actually, we lived in the slit trenches, and if the ground was firm, we'd put the carrier over top of the slit trench, and you felt pretty safe then, but you've got to be careful if it'd been raining, because they could sink down, and some lads had got actually squashed with the vehicle slipping down onto them. But on the whole, it wasn't bad. And then we'd started getting these 14-men packs from the American Army, which were good grub. It was tin beef puddings, tin rice puddings, big change from just corned beef and that. And we had the rice pudding, I think I said that, but we had, what was the other thing? Oh, bacon. I liked the bacon, the tin bacon wrapped in cellophane it was. Right, good. And how we cooked was, I'd fill the earth, fill a tin with earth, square tin with earth, pour petrol in it, then fill another tin with water and put it on top, and with the petrol being in the earth, it would burn for ages, and we could boil the tins and then we'd have a good meal then. Mind you, as we went further into the continent, we started picking a bit of ham up from a farm and things like that. I had one or two hams, because we being a butcher are all right at things like that. So I always remember when we got into one country, the battalion orders come out and said, there's swine fever about, so you mustn't be eating this, that. And I put it to the lads, I said, do you want to have these slices of ham and risk swine fever, or should I chuck it away? They said, we'll risk the swine fever.
How did you keep clean?
Well, at one time, in Normandy, you went back, and they'd have a concert somewhere, and you could have a bath and all that. Well, I weren't interested in the concert. All I were interested in was getting clean laundry and having a bath. And I only saw the entertainers from a distance. I only saw them once. But they did get you clean clothes and that, and you had a bath. But you had to just go back for that. And like I said, there was entertainment, but weren't interested in getting clean.
How did you do it? How did you keep clean in the field?
Well, you had to wait. You didn't get a change until next time you can get back to doings. You just shaved and that. I mean, I always used to get some hot water out of one of the truck's radiators and have a shave. When we went into Normandy, we'd had a lot of Canadian young officers attached to us, and we'd sent some young British officers to the Canadians. And they were very good, but nearly all of them got wounded or killed. And I suppose that happened. There was very heavy casualties in the young lieutenants. I remember once they kept putting them, instead of, we was behind this hill, but they kept putting them in this forward position on the hill, and the jury could lob bombs in just like on a fairground. Because it ran the wrong, I wouldn't have gone down there, but I suppose second lieutenant couldn't do anything else. I'd have pointed out that you were just a sitting target like that, whereas if you got back over the rim of the hill, you could observe without being just there to be, you know, bombed as they wanted. Because they kept reinforcing them. As one got wounded, they'd take him and another one and go. Waste of time. They should have kept them behind the top of the hill instead of putting them on the forward slope. I always remember that. It was crackers.
Was there a lot of casualties amongst the other ranks?
Oh, yes. You see, I remember one time, the bloke I'd run the Aussie with, Mufti Hughes, he was in D Company then, and I remember we were in this orchid at Mount Orchard, and one of the lads said, hey, your mate's got it. I said, who? He said, Mufti. He said, he's in that field there, just in that coppice. Oh, I went to Luke, and all we used to do was wrap him in a blanket with the boots showing. And I'd never seen a civilian up to then, and this farmer come from nowhere, and he wanted the boots off him. And I, he pointed at Mufti's boots, and I, that mad, I said, if you don't so-and-so, I'll shoot you. I mean, I know later on somebody had pinched his boots, but I weren't letting anybody pinch his boots while they lay there at my feet, I'll tell you. I remember another time we came out of this small wood, and there was this road, and you could tell nobody had been down it, and there were all twigs on it and scattered things. And so we had a young officer who just come for his reinforcements, because they were, he got heavy at casualty amongst the young officers. And he was going to go down it, and I said, it looks as though it's not, it's mine, that. I said, I wouldn't go down yet. Oh, he said, yes, it'd be all right. And so he set off. Well, he was in a jeep. So he went over, whatever. But and then another carrier went over it. But the second carrier that went over must have just triggered it off, must have been the weight. And it blew up, and they had bad casualties in that carrier. But the, well, it weren't a funny part, but the point was, as we blew up, as this blew up, there were haystacks, small haystacks on either side of the road, and Germans appeared from behind them. They'd been in slit trenches. They could have polished us off. Well, with that surprise, it was a perfect ambush. But they didn't want to know. They come out with their hands up. They could have killed a lot of us. Because we were all there in the road, and these little air stacks didn't... Oh, they planned it marvellous, but they surrendered, which I was glad of.
Did you have much contact with the Germans, and what were they like?
Well, the first lot of Germans was mixed. I think there was different Romanians, Poles, all sorts. But as we got farther in the fighting, they were the first we were capturing. You got the arrogant SS and that, you see, and some blonde, arrogant so-and-sos. And I know one of the lads taking a watch off, and this bloke said, you can't do that, you know. He said, I'll report you. And this young fella said, report me. If you don't keep your mouth shut, you're not going to go any further back to report anybody. So he gave him his watch then. Said, you can have it. So that were all right. Everybody settled in peace.
Did you have much contact with any other Allied troops?
Well, not on the ground at first in Normandy, but we saw the American aircraft, and it was a standing joke that if the Germans were bombing, German aircraft were bombing, the English ducked, and if the English planes were bombing, the Germans ducked, but if the Americans were bombing, everybody ducked. But they always seemed to knock the head off your column. When you were moving and that, the bomb shot, there always seemed to be an area to get the bombs dropped and such a thing. I mean, I might be libelling them now, but we might have just been unlucky, but it were well known about them that they'd knock the head of your column off. I don't think they really knew the recognised signs for who were who and who were not, you know.
Did you deal with any of the Canadians or...?
All the Canadians were good soldiers, but they got a lot of casualties in Normandy. I always remember seeing at the side of the road as we were going along, a lot of Canadians, a lot of Staffordshire Regiment. Them were the two lots I seen a lot of at the side of the road, you know, Canadians and staffs. Towards the end of the Normandy campaign, we got to Falaise. Oh, what a mess that was. The planes must have played havoc with them, must have caught them cold. And I always remember driving my carrier through there, and I could see on one dead German a beautiful watch glinting. And I was very tempted to go, and I thought, no, I bet that's a booby trap, you know. But and then maybe my conscience won't let me take a watch off a dead man, you know. Took it off alive, man. But after seeing this glinting watch, it wasn't all pleasant. There was these animals blown up and the trucks and everything. But black animals, how they get on the back and the legs straight up in the air and the stomach's extended. Oh, terrible sight, terrible smell. War's no good to nobody.
Did you see much evidence of aircraft in Normandy?
Oh, yes, there was... a great deal of aircraft bombed Caen. The only trouble was, that the Germans pulled back when the bombing was on. And so when they come back, the more defences of rubble and that. So it wasn't very successful, the heavy bombing of Caen.
Did you see the aircraft attacking?
Oh, yes, we was observing. We were watching, we were trying to capture Caen. So I was in the fields watching this aircraft, and there was some aircraft. But according to information, the Germans just withdrew from there, and then when the bombing were over, they came back. But the casualties, I believe, amongst the French was heavy.
What type of formation were they in?
The aircraft came over in waves, and there was lots of them, lots and lots of them. But it took a long while to take Caen. It was a real stumbling block. After the slow progress in Normandy, we were really moving fast, and we went through France very quick, and then we were in the northern part of Belgium, and bypassing Brussels and so on, and everything was looking good for a quick end to the war, but there were more things to come what we didn't know about, and actually we got put with 30 Corps for the Operation Market Garden.
What part did your battalion play in Operation Market Garden?
Well, we was actually there to guard the corridor from being cut, because they would keep trying to cut it and stop supplies getting to them.
Where did the corridor run from?
Well, it run from coming from Belgium right up to Nijmegen. That was the big town, and then it went on a little bit further. But I did one or two trips up to Nijmegen. But it was getting heavily shelled when I was there.
What was the terrain like?
Well, it was very flat, actually. And American troops had dropped at, I think, a place called Graves, and then some had dropped higher up at Nijmegen. But Arnhem was just a little bit too far, and it was a very rough job. While we're in the corridor, we saw these paratroopers start coming back. Of course, I didn't know how bad they'd had it higher up. I had no idea at all how bad they had. And I just said, I ain't going home again now. Do you only come out for 4 days and then you're back in your billet? I said, we're here all the time. But the heads were down, so I thought something must have gone wrong badly.
What type of warfare was it at this stage?
Well, we were at the side of the Mars, and it was pretty static and quietish. And we did hear that we were going to go into Eindhoven, civvy billets for Christmas, so we're all chuffed with that. So,
did you have any contact with the Germans at all?
Only local shelling. Not heavy shelling, but just shelling. Just about this time, we was getting ready to think we were going into Eindhoven, and I felt rotten. So I said, I'll go back and see the MO, see if he'll give me some tablets. Anyway, when I went to him, he took my temperature and said, I were 104 and I got tonsillitis. So I had to go and get on a stretcher in the schoolroom, and they gave me these M&B tablets. And the morning after, my temperature had come down rapidly. But I'd all like pigeon eggs that had come up in my back. Very painful. Because the medical orderly said to me, is your temperature all right? I said, I feel all right there. I said, but my back's killing me. So he said, I'll tell the MO. Anyway, at this time, word come through that the Americans had broken through the Germans had broken through the American lines, and that we were going down with 30 Corps. So I was pushed in ambulance and taken into Belgium, still having M&B tablets and what have you. And when we got into Belgium, they came around and said, oh, I said, I'm not feeling so bad, only my back's killing me. I've got these lumps like pigeon eggs in it. I don't know what caused them. So they stuck needles in me. Now, I'd had plenty of needles in when we'd had these precautionary.
You were just saying you'd had plenty of needles when you'd had precautionary
jabs. So I was quite used to them, but these were different. And anyway, they did it in one side of my back, and the following morning it were no better. So they give me another jab, and I fell off the table where they give me on a table. So I thought, I'm having no more of them. So I said, it's a lot better now. And I was sent back to the battalion because we were in the Ardennes. But our carriers were no good going up the Ardennes in the snow. So in a place called Bastogne, we were sent to borrow some what they call weasels, later called snowcats, off the Americans. And they went up the hills like gondolas, glided up. And I remember I had to keep supplying our forward sections with ammunition and food. So I was gliding up the top of the hill. I went round this bend and I saw the biggest Tiger tank. It were a Royal Tiger, never seen one before. And it was planted there right in the middle of the road. And I'd just come round the bend, so I was practically under the gun. And I just saw there was a pathway at the side. So whether this Royal Tiger had been hit with the typhoons or been run out of petrol, I don't know. But I was so glad to get round it, you see. And but these weasels, what the Americans, they no doubt they had the kit, the Americans. We kept our lads in forward positions going, and we got a lot of casualties. In fact, in the farmers, what they're using as headquarters, our adjutant and CO got a shell hit them and they were killed while we were in the Ardennes. So it was a rough period, actually.
Where did you go at the end of the Ardennes campaign?
Well, we went up towards the Reichwald Forest, which was part of the Siegfried Line, and we knew it'd be a tough nut to crack. And it was very rough in the forest. In fact, reporters who worked for British papers said the Reichwald Forest was the nearest thing to the First World War, with the mud and one thing and another.
What was the terrain like?
Oh, it was very woody, but there was a big main road ran right up into the centre of it. And I used to be running backwards and forwards on my brain carrier there, you see, and we were getting reinforcements because we'd lost a lot of infantry. And I always remember going back with my brain carrier to pick these reinforcements up. And when I saw them, there was about six or eight of them. And I thought, oh, these are young. So I said, how old are you? And some were 18 and a half, some were 19. And I said, where have you come from? And they'd come all straight out from England. And I thought, there's thousands and thousands of soldiers all the way back to Norman, and these lads are coming straight from England, in for a rough time in this forest. Anyway, I hung on the outskirts of the forest until it got dusk, and then I had to take them up. And I took them up, and I said, I'm going to drop you in this ditch, jump out in this ditch, but I'm not going to turn the carrier until you've got away from here, because I said, when to turn the carrier, I've got to lock one track and rev up like hell, and I'll spin round. But as soon as Jerry hears that, he won't half drop some clutter here, so get away from here, and good luck, lads. And so I'd go off then, that'd be back just on the outskirts of the forest, and the following morning I'd be going up again with ammunition and food and everything. But the sore point was, I was bringing six bodies back. Not saying that the lads I took up could have been anywhere, because they were wrapped in the blanket like with just the boots showing. And I thought, oh hell, have they only had one night of war, or is it not them, but it was somebody? And so I had to take them bodies back and bring more food up and ammunition.
So after the fighting in the Reichwald Forest, you were into Germany?
Yes, and I remember after, I don't know whether it's in context or not, but crossing the Rhine, because we were there watching when the paratroopers come over and dropped on the other side, and we to follow up as quick as possible. And they got some bridges across, but driving a brain carrier across one of them floating bridges, it doesn't seem a lot of room. Anyway, when we got across, it was all flames and what have you at the other side, and we went through it, and we're really getting on top of the job then.
Do you remember the moment you entered into Germany at all?
Not really, but I remember one. I was driving my carrier early morning. I landed in this town or whatever it was, and I was in the middle of a square, and I could see all these buildings around this square, and there were white flags hanging out. So I thought, oh, they're giving up, I hope. And so that's how we were then. And then we went on, and I think we were between Bremen and Hamburg, and we pulled at the side, and I know for the anti-tank crew, I'd cooked some breakfast, and then I said, I'd had mine. I said, you get your breakfast while I watch the road. And I saw some of these strange uniforms coming down, and it was some of the Jewish prisoners out of one of the camps. I didn't know the camp near there, but I believe after it was Belsen, I think. But they were coming down the road, so I waved them through. I had to keep a close eye in case of some Germans trying to get through with them. So anyway, I waved them through. I said, you'll be all right when you get back. You keep going, keep going. And so that was it. And they got on path, the lads come, and then we moved up towards Hamburg. And while we're stationed outside Hamburg, we're stationed in this field, and we hear all these rumours, no firing for 200 yards either side of the road. And then we see these big black cars coming up with leather-clad German soldiers in, look like generals or colonels or something. And we said, hey, there's something going on. And they said, oh, they're going on Ludenburg Heath. And so we kept near the road because we thought, well, if there's no shelling here, we have a chance of living through this.
Was the shelling going on either side of the road?
There weren't a lot of shelling. There was some shelling in a copse a couple of fields over. And this, a young officer had only just joined us, because there are always reinforcements for young officers. They had a lot of heavy casualties. And so he says, take your carrier over there, you know, and see what's, you know, go and put yourself in position. But I thought, there's no down for that. So one of the lads knocked the pin out of the track, and I said, oh, the track's off, so we'll have to leave it. He said, okay, never sent anybody else. So we're all, nobody went across to that copse, and we're all trying to be careful now. We could see the end of the war, and we'd been through so much together. We didn't, none of us wanted to be wounded or killed on the last minute. But I believe we'd had so many casualties from Normandy, at least, I mean, so it was 800 or 900 strong, the battalion, when we set off. We'd had over 1,800 casualties, killed, missing and wounded, so that were nearly a 3-to-1 ratio, that you were either killed or wounded. And so,
did you have any antagonism towards the Germans?
No, not really. They had to be, well, we thought we'd be having a heavy battle for Hamburg. I'm very glad they'd surrendered. They surrendered 48 hours before the end of the war. So it was very, you know, nicer, because they had so many 88mm as ACAC guns. If they'd have pulled them down to fire at us, we'd had a lot more casualties. Anyway, we had to drive into Hamburg, and the police were either side of the road. Some had like a green uniform on, and some had like white coats, but they all had Lugers. So we thought, we'll have some of them, because they were no good to us, because we'd be on a charge if we got caught with them. But we knew we could sell them to the Americans for good money. And I always remember asking the Americans, well, we see, we moved down to Oberhausen lately in the Ruhr, and saw a lot of Americans there, and we sold them to them. And I used to say, what do you do with them now? And they said, we'll post them home. These policemen stood at intervals. They'd kept the firearms to keep law and order, actually. But we were leapfrogging each other, and I'd say to the lad, go and get his gun, because we knew we could make some money out of him. We hadn't a lot of sympathy for the Germans, because we'd lost so much time. I'd been in the army, I only went in for six months, and I'd done nearly 7 years. So I'd lost a lot of money, and my wife had had a hard time, so I wanted something back.
Where were the other German population?
Though they had to be off the streets for 48 hours, and so you could see them peeping. All the houses were badly damaged, so you could see them peeping out of the cellars, just over the top of the cellar, looking at us, frightened to death, actually. But they had to be off the streets for 48 hours. We were ordered to take the carrier down to the docks and sort things out down there. When we got down there, we pulled up near a big warehouse shed, and there was a German in there, and like a lot in these big ports, he could speak English. So we're having a look around, he told us some whiskey there. So we had a look in these boxes. Oh, and there were all the brands you could ever wish for. Dimple brand, black and white, liquors from Holland. Oh, it was Bulls' sherry brandy, everything you could mention. So I said to this workman, I said, how the heck have you got this, all this Scottish whiskey and that? He said, well, he said, we trade with Sweden and Sweden trades with Scotland. So he said, and so it's come, we've got it from Sweden. I said, yeah, we're going to get it back off you because really ours, you shouldn't have this. So we had, they were like in big tea chests, so we hadn't opened, we hadn't room for big tea chests. So I thought, it's time I give this anti-tank gun of mine up to the one who were carrying the bombs. I said, you drag this, now I'm going to get a trailer. And I got a lovely box trailer, which we filled up with all the best whiskey you could get. Because I knew once the officers heard about this, there'd be 3 tonners coming down to empty it. So we make sure we got all our lockers full of whiskey and one thing or another. Chuck the camouflage nets into the river at the port. So everything was doing fine, and we thought, well, things couldn't get better now because we got through the war and we're still alive. Right, once we got ourselves loaded up with all the whiskey we could carry, we decided to open a little pub. There was a pub there, so we opened it. And the young officer was there, he hadn't been with us long, a great lad. And so he was acting as the barman. So everything's going fine until 2 MPs come in, and they said, you know, they were going to book this officer, and we all got round them, and I suppose we looked a little bit menacing, because they decided to leave and let the young officer enjoy himself.
What was your attitude towards MPs?
Well, I didn't think much about that state, but the point was, when we were in Normandy, I remember seeing an MP. It was on this crossroads, and everything was flying in the... Oh, it were really getting shelled. But you see, he kept there because if he hadn't kept there and kept the traffic flowing, it'd have been the right pile-up. So I had great respect for his courage. So, you see, different circumstances, different men.